In the wider ancient Near East, the dead were seen to become invisible spirits that could both help and hinder living relatives. A commonly shared concept of life after death led to a reciprocal dependency between the living and the dead. The dead relied on the living for drink and food offerings, and the living depended on their dead forebears to help them secure divine blessings within the non-human sphere, and to legitimate their current social standing within the extended family, past, present, and future. A close look at the biblical texts reveals that such beliefs were widespread before consulting the dead came to be condemned. My main focus will be on those living in the kingdom of Judah during the period from about 975 to 586 BCE, whose descendants composed or edited most of the texts of the Hebrew Bible. Let us begin with terms for the dead in the Bible. They move from descriptions of the state of the human body, dead and corpse, to disembodied life force, being, ghosts, and spirits of the dead, that partake of the separated sacred realm, holy ones and divine ones. Those who cross over would be those who enter the realm of the dead, Sheol, where they exist in a new disembodied state, and yet can still be in close proximity to the buried physical body in its grave. Finally, as knowing ones, the transformed dead have knowledge of the invisible other world of which they are now a part. A two-step process is reflected in the biblical texts by which a powerless dead body became an influential ancestral spirit. In Genesis, for example, Abraham's death and burial by his sons Isaac and Ishmael is set off from a prior, more important statement that he was gathered to his people. This phrase seems to express the same idea as the related phrases, to be gathered to one's forebears or ancestors, to be gathered to one's grave, and to sleep with one's fathers or ancestors. It is likely that the consistent distinction between burial and the gathering to the ancestors reflects a two-stage process that begins with placing the dead body in the tomb, but which is not completed until the spirit of the deceased has fully transitioned and joined its forebears in Sheol. Since this is the more crucial phrase that ensures the spirit's escape from liminality to the netherworld, it is mentioned first. The primary emphasis of the idiom is on the spirit's safe arrival in the netherworld, where its relatives have gathered to greet it and welcome it amongst its numbers. Sheol. The dead, when properly buried, went to the underworld or netherworld, which was called Sheol in the Bible. This was not a common name for the hereafter in surrounding cultures, where the term earth was used regularly to designate this realm. Earth is also used in the Hebrew Bible as an alternative designation for the realm of the dead. Sheol was conceived as a city of the dead. It has gates, bars, and houses, which are the tombs of the buried. It is a broad domain, a land of darkness and gloom that, in one passage, is reached by crossing a river. There are hints that it was conceived at times as a prison. Turning now to archaeological evidence. During the time of the Kingdom of Judah, two primary forms of burial for those with social standing or wealth appear to have been used: caves or hewn chambers, and bench tombs or arcosolia. In caves or chambers hewn into the soft limestone, newer bodies were laid out with grave goods in the center of the floor space, while older ancestors and goods were relocated to the peripheral benches. Bench tombs and arcosolia consisted of hewn chambers that had two or three waist-high benches lining the walls. Here is a picture where we have two benches with the steps coming down through the middle. Often they had bone repositories, You can see in the lower right-hand corner the bone repository, and there's looking inside of one, that were cut into or under the benches. Or, in case of the archosolia, there were compartments that held single permanent bodies. Here is another picture of two adjoining benches. Here, we don't have a separate repository, but you can see how the bones are all, the bodies are laid out, and as new ones are laid out, the other ones are just swept to the floor. Like the cave and chamber burials, bench tombs involved a two-step process of deposition, after which a person was officially gathered to his or her ancestors. The chamber-cut tombs could be a single unadorned room or be quite elaborate, with multiple chambers off a central courtyard and wall frescoes, imitation sunken wooden panels, gabled ceilings, and parapets simulating a real house. The multi-generational accumulation of ancestral remains indicates the house-style tomb symbolizes the collective identity of a given family or kin group, whose members would continue to occupy common family space in death as in life. The term Beit, house, is used in some biblical passages to describe the tomb or grave, which links nicely with this style of tomb favored by the wealthy and powerful in Judah during the Iron Tomb period or the monarchy. Beit also designates a family lineage, and in the case of royalty, a dynastic line. Grave goods were deposited beside the body in the first phase of interment on a bench. All bodies in Judah were accompanied by an oil lamp and a chalice. In addition, a number of vessels for the storage, preparation, and serving of food and beverages were added. Personal items often accompanied the body: game pieces for leisure time, a personal stamp or seal, jewelry, especially Egyptianizing scarabs and amulets, and sometimes miniature clay figurines and models of furniture. The texts fail to mention grave goods, so these provide additional new information for the historian. But in the absence of clarifying texts, the purpose and symbolism of the grave goods remains ambiguous, demonstrating the limits of interpreting silent archaeological evidence. So we will turn now to ancestral spirits as sources of help to the living. As in many cultures around the world today, the dead in ancient Judah were seen to remain part of the extended family and to have concern for their living descendants. In the ensuing sections, we will examine evidence from the Hebrew Bible and archaeology that indicates ancient Judahites considered their ancestors to bless the crops and land, to send children, and to cause illness and misfortune. So we'll start with the blessing of crops and securing of land inheritance. The belief that the ancestors had once been viewed as responsible for the success or failures of crops grown on family allotments is indicated by the oath in Deuteronomy 26, verses 13 through 15, that was sworn when a person presented his or her tithe, well, his tithe most certainly, from the new harvest of foodstuffs to Adonai. By the time the law code of Deuteronomy was in force, which was possibly by the end of the monarchy, but more likely in the Persian-era community, practices that had been widespread and acceptable in the earlier monarchic period were banned. Two important implications can be drawn from this oath. First, it suggests that the dead at one point had been considered divine beings to whom consecrated food, rather than ordinary food, was either due or permitted. The oath does not prohibit the making of food offerings to ancestors per se. Rather, it precludes the use of foodstuffs set aside as consecrated and owed as part of the tithe paid to the national god Adonai to feed family and clan ancestral spirits. Second, reinforced by comparative ethnographic practice, is the belief that the ancestors were directly responsible for the fertility of the land and annual yields. It can be noted that among the Fon of Benin and southwest Nigeria, and the Karanga of Zimbabwe, for example, the first fruits of every harvest are given to the ancestors, who were thought to have blessed the seed before it was planted. Since the tithe for Adonai would have been set aside soon after each harvest was completed, the oath in Deuteronomy would have been aimed at suppressing the practice of crediting the ancestors with any role in the success of the annual harvest of barley, wheat, or fruits. The final affirmation that Adonai would bless the land flowing with milk and honey that he gave the ancestors drives home this point by crediting him as the sole source of the land's fertility. Much has been made of the role of the ancestors in validating legitimate land claims through the placement of tombs on patrimonies. The Book of Joshua in particular depicts the apportioning of the promised land to the clans comprising the 12 tribes of Israel, establishing an ideal past in which all the land was communally held clan land, and so, in theory, unable to be sold to outsiders. Each Beit Av, which represented either a nuclear or extended family lineage, would have been entitled to a share of clan land. However, specific lots of clan land would have been redistributed periodically among eligible clan males in a move to give all members an equal chance of being able to farm the best land, the worst land, and the so-so land from over time. Most of the excavated tombs dating to the monarchic era were located in areas adjoining cities and towns, making it unlikely they lay on ancestral land. No evidence has yet surfaced in the territory of Judah during the monarchic era for burial under the floors of houses or in individual graves. The tombs cut into the cliffs of the wadis around Jerusalem were not laying claim to private or communal land. Neither were the burials of commoners said to have been located in the Kidron Valley. Few excavations of farmstead complexes have taken place, so it cannot be determined if tombs in the rural sector would have been located on the family estate to lay claim to its land, as has frequently been asserted, or on land adjoining the local village, or on land in a shared clan cemetery. A survey of the Rephaim Valley, southwest of Jerusalem, has revealed a network of walled farmsteads that date to the end of the monarchy, a few of which have been partially excavated. At Eras, a cave for burial has been identified within the perimeter of the walled four-acre complex. We can see the walls there. We don't exactly know how the walls came down here. In this documented case and any other similar ones, it is possible to talk about the interment in a family tomb that would logically lay claim to specific land that was expected to be handed down from generation to generation. But this was not the only form of land tenure. The ancestors were likely to have been seen to be the guarantors of the fertility of whatever land was worked by their descendants, as well as the fertility of their herds. It is important to bear in mind that in the case of land held jointly by a clan, a mishpacha, ancestral tombs would not have been located on permanently allotted plots owned by individual households, but rather in a clan burial ground located somewhere on commonly held land. Now we will look at ancestors who send children. The belief of ancient Judahites that their ancestors could provide them with offspring is confirmed by the placing of female figurines in tombs from time to time. The so-called Judean pillar figurine was a standard form throughout the Kingdom of Judah, especially in the 8th and 7th centuries. They have been found in widespread primary and secondary contexts, including tombs. The function of Judean pillar figurines when placed in tombs has been debated, though it is widely recognized that their scarcity indicates they were not a standard grave good. Given the prominence of breasts on the figurines, Elizabeth Block Smith has argued the placement of such a figurine in a tomb was intended to evoke sympathetic magical powers on behalf of the living childbearing family members for adequate lactation to sustain newborns and infants. Roz Kletter has rejected that idea explicitly and proposed instead that they would have been personal items that had belonged to the deceased before death that were to accompany the spirit to the next world. Carl van der Toorn and Herbert Neer offer a third option. They see Judean pillar figurines in tombs to be mass-produced imitations of cult images located in temples, in this case likely representing the goddess Asherah, which indicates a belief that the dead were still in the presence of an important god they had worshipped in life, who could continue to be petitioned in prayer as a source of protection and devotion. Once again, we confront the limits of interpreting silent archaeological evidence. But help is at hand. A female figurine of a nude woman holding a baby found in a tomb in Egypt bears an inscription that provides a unique glimpse of its intended function when deposited in a tomb. A daughter asks her deceased father to send her a child. A parallel request for a child was written on a jar currently housed in the Haskell Oriental Museum of Chicago, addressed to a dead father. Both inscriptions indicate a belief that an ancestral spirit, an Ach, can help heal barrenness by driving away whatever demon is preventing conception, or by overturning whatever spell may have been cast to prevent pregnancy. It also illustrates a belief that the perpetuation of the family lineage by biological offspring and their spouses is of concern to ancestral spirits. The book of Genesis has many instances of barren women being healed. It strongly asserts that Adonai alone is the source of both barrenness and healing that opens the womb and permits conception. There is here an implied polemic against any other perceived source of human fertility, be that a goddess like Asherah or ancestral spirits who may act independently or may intercede with a fertility deity on behalf of the barren person to open a womb so a barren female descendant can conceive. Now we will consider consulting the dead. Belief that spirits are able to disclose important information to the living if consulted by an intermediary is indicated by texts that describe the dead as holy ones, divine ones, or knowing ones. The best known example, probably, is in 1 Samuel 28, where Saul is said to break his own decree that had banned knowing ones and ghost inquirers from the land by using a ghost mistress to summon up the spirit of the dead prophet Samuel to learn what would happen at the battle the next day against the Philistines. The story depicts Saul as being desperate because Adonai has refused to provide him with an oracular answer. Samuel's spirit comes up, but is not happy about having been disturbed. It confirms that Adonai has taken away the kingdom and given it to Saul's neighbor for disobedience, and that Saul and his sons will be with it in Sheol by the end of the battle on the next day. In Isaiah 8, verses 19 through 20, Adonai warns Isaiah not to listen to those who are counseling the prophet to inquire of the ghosts and knowing ones that chirp and moan. They believe divine ones, who here would be the ancestral spirits, can be sought for instruction and a message. This text affirms a once common belief that the ancestral dead partake in some form of divinity and can be consulted for help, even though it is trying to deny their efficacy. Two more texts likewise proclaim that such a role for the ancestors is mislaid. All three texts likely reflect a late developing perspective that denies any power to the ancestors as intervening spirits, because all knowledge derives from Adonai alone. Another passage, Isaiah 57, 3 through 10, condemns those who engage in consultation of the dead. Those who follow a female necromancer are described as seeking comfort from the divine dead and of slaughtering children in the valleys underneath the cleft in the rocks in verses 3 through 6. The ensuing verses 7 through 10 go on to describe necromantic activities that are carried out within a tomb setting, where ancestral spirits are offered sacrifices and then are asked to provide information that, according to the writer, properly belongs only to Adonai. The passage seems to refer to a rock-cut chamber tomb located in the Wadi cliffs surrounding Jerusalem that resembles a house in having a frame doorway carved into the stone. Inside is a memorial stela representing the dead, perhaps collectively. Either the stela is also anointed with oil and fragrant balm, or these items are used as offerings to a deity or leader of the dead assembly associated with the underworld who bears the title Molech. The purpose of the visit is to seek advice from the dead in Sheol. After chastisement for not remembering Adonai and an assertion that God will not help them when they cry out, but instead will cause a wind to carry away those who have been sought instead of the true God, verse 13 ties all the necromantic practices to the issue of land, property, and lineage. The text concludes by asserting that land entitlement passes through Adonai, not through the dead ancestors. The prohibitions in Leviticus chapter 19, verses 31, chapter 20, verse 6, chapter 20, verse 27, and Deuteronomy 18, 11, against using the services of necromancers to consult the dead under penalty of death, indicate a clear change in attitude designed to eliminate the view of ancestral spirits as sources of divine knowledge and help. It is consistent with other attempts already noted to deny there is any knowledge in Sheol or that the ancestors are responsible for crop or human fertility. Vengeful spirits. Proper burial was considered extremely important so that the deceased could rest comfortably for eternity. A ghost whose body was never buried could become forever restless, as could a ghost whose grave was disturbed. Comparative texts from other cultures express a similar idea. The Epic of Gilgamesh confirms that the ghost of the unburied is not at rest in the underworld. When King Ashurbanipal of Assyria was campaigning, his royal annals report, he made the spirits of the dead kings of Elam restless by destroying their tombs and carrying away their bones to Assyria. There are a few passages in the Hebrew Bible that refer to the removal of bones from tombs, and either they're burning or they're spreading on the open ground like dung. In 2 Kings chapter 23, verses 15 through 18, the tombs of the priests of Bethel are emptied of their bones, which are then burned on the temple altar, defiling it. Yet, the tomb of the old prophet of Bethel that contained his bones, as well as those of the man of God from Judah, who had predicted this would happen, was left undisturbed, demonstrating part of the intended result of this action, was the deliberate condemnation of the once peaceful ghosts of the priest of Bethel to eternal restlessness. The book of Jeremiah predicts that those newly killed in the war between Neo-Babylonia and Jerusalem will fall like dung on the open field, and none will gather them to their ancestors in Sheol, bury them, or mourn them, creating a mass of restless spirits who cannot enter Sheol. These passages indicate a belief that the unburied newly dead will become ghosts condemned to walk the earth, and that the already dead who have transitioned peacefully to Sheol can be turned into restless spirits long after their death by the deliberate actions of those on earth. Incantation texts designed to prevent ghosts doing harm to their relatives or others in Assyria and Babylonia indicate that the neglect of mortuary cult observance is a prime reason for a dead spirit to turn hostile and harmful and take to wandering the earth and haunting the living. So was death by murder, drowning, starvation, dehydration, and a weapon. Various incantations show that illness was attributed to persecution by ghosts. Although the Hebrew Bible has no comparable documents to the Mesopotamian incantation texts, the few texts cited above indicate a belief in the ability to condemn the unburied dead and those properly buried but deliberately disturbed to restlessness, which implies a likely belief in vengeful ancestral spirits who could cause deliberate illness and harm, also in Judah. The failure to make mortuary offerings regularly to the familial ancestral spirits probably also would have been seen to be a reason for them to become hostile and vengeful. So, quick conclusion. We have seen that a few passages indicate that during the time of the monarchy, after a two-step burial process, many of the dead were believed to be transformed into powerful ancestral spirits who resided in the underworld of Sheol. They continued to be part of their families and were concerned about the ongoing success of the family lineage. They were thought to be responsible for the success or failure of annual harvests and for human fertility and perhaps even sterility, and could be consulted by the living for information concerning decisions that would be made in the invisible divine realm. Those not properly buried, those whose graves were subsequently disturbed, and those who did not receive adequate care and offerings could become angry spirits that would punish living relatives and other non-related individuals. Passages come to assert that Adonai controls Sheol, which seems to overturn other passages that assert it was a realm that lay outside his reach and jurisdiction. The few mentions of Sheol as a place of forgetting may also reflect a secondary development meant to challenge a former belief that the dead became knowing ones. The prohibition against necromancy in the laws in Deuteronomy and Leviticus has as an important purpose the demotion of the ancestors from semi-divine or minor divine beings to the status of honored dead. They no longer were to serve as a conduit to help their living descendants secure life, blessing, and progeny. Adonai was to be the sole source of such petitions. Thank you.